So this interview is just me and Arun Kundani, who of course came on the show previously to talk about his book, The Muslims Are Coming.
He's awesome.
So awesome. He talks about coming from a black liberation socialist ideology as a background.
Oh, great.
So that's just a teaser for where this interview
is going. Oh, man, I was already excited. Now I'm even more excited.
Yeah, and, you know, we talk a lot about the vacuum of ideologies that exist in opposition to neoliberalism, and that is why some people turn to political Islam, because the left was systemically dismantled by UK and US authorities during the Cold War. It's a lot of stuff that I have kind of like tried to talk about on the show, perhaps inarticulately, that Arun Kundani just like lays out beautifully.
Excellent.
So let's get to that interview right now. We welcome back to the show Arun Kundani, author of The Muslims Are Coming, Islamophobia, Extremism, and the Domestic War on Terror. Arun, thanks for coming back on Radio Dispatch.
My pleasure.
Obviously, I want to talk about your reactions to the shooting in Paris. But one thing that I wanted to start off with is this idea that we hear from U.S. Officials, security officials, is that the West, so-called, is at war with an ideology. And whether it's Al-Qaeda or ISIS or whatever, you know, particular group it is, the U.S. Calls Islamism an ideology, but not neoliberalism an ideology. So, you know, in your book, you lay out some of the ways in which leftist ideologies were dismantled in the previous decade. So could you kind of take us through that history of how the West dismantled various leftist ideologies?
Yeah, I mean, so one of the things that I was interested in the book was looking at how there's actually a long historical story about the relationship between the United States and Islam, right, and various forms of political Islam, movements that are seeking to use ideas from the Islamic tradition to bring about some kind of political agenda in the 20th century. What you see is that at different times, political Islam is seen as an ally, and at other times it's seen as an enemy. And that's really nothing to do with the ideological content of Islamist groups or political Islamic groups at any one time, but is entirely to do with the kind of geopolitics of that moment. So Saudi Arabia, for example, of all the regimes that define themselves as in some way Islamic, surely the most reactionary, has been an ally right through the Cold War and the War on Terror, because it's happy to align itself with US foreign policy interests. And obviously we're all familiar with the story of the Afghan Mujahideen that we supported in the 1980s to defeat Soviet communism. Less well known is the way that we also sponsored political Islam within Europe itself. The CIA did that, European governments did that, as a way to counter left-wing radicalism coming out of immigrant communities within Europe. And so, for example, in the 1980s in England, young South Asians, some of whom came from Muslim backgrounds, who were active on issues like racism and immigration and so forth. They did that for a secular leftist politics, you know, often inspired by the Black Panther Party here in the US or by the anti-colonial movements coming from the Indian subcontinent. And so in order to counter that, the government actually encouraged the more conservative mosque leaders to get together and be a kind of alternative community voice. And it was those very mosque leaders who then, a few years later, in 1989, 1990, are the ones who are burning copies of Salman Rushdie's Satanic Verses book. And so at that, and then going forward in the 90s, it's the people who were formerly allies who become the new enemies, because a geopolitical situation changes with the end of the Cold War. Instead of communism being the enemy, Islam or some concept of radical Islam becomes the enemy. And coming up to the present day, you know, what we've been sold over the last 20 years by terrorism experts, so-called terrorism experts, whether they're coming from academic departments or whether they're coming from law enforcement agencies or neoconservative think tanks, we've been sold this basic myth, which is that the reason that we are in a conflict with groups like Al-Qaeda is because there are bad ideologies out there that are turning Muslims into fanatics. And actually what that leaves out is the role of our own foreign policy in creating political contexts within which political violence, terrorism becomes more likely. And obviously we've seen that time and time again, whether you think about the Iraq War, whether you think about our drone strikes policies. You know, right now we are bombing Iraq for the fourth time since the Cold War ended. We are entering another cycle of that same violence.
And to the extent that that political Islam as it exists right now seems to offer the only, perhaps for some people, the only alternative to neoliberalism, whereas in previous generations you saw a more kind of like left-wing anti-imperial movement. Do you think that political Islam for some in the West has sort of filled a vacuum, that there has to be if you want to oppose neoliberalism, you have to have something, and this just happens to be that something because it's not left-wing anti-imperial movements.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's something like that was happening in the 1990s in Europe. So, you know, at a time in the aftermath of the Cold War, when the message was this is the end of history, there's no longer any alternative to neoliberal capitalism, and you know, that message was being propagated while most of the world is still suffering the injustices of neoliberal capitalism. And so at that point, for some people, Islam becomes a way of trying to define an alternative and a method for achieving that alternative when the left looks like it's being defeated, right? So certainly, you know, I interviewed for my book a number of people who came from Muslim families who'd settled in England, who became left-wing radicals, but then by the 90s, with the defeat of the left, in England, for example, they started to see Islam maybe as a way of addressing the same injustices that had initially led them to some kind of socialism. And so there is a way in which, you know, with the official story is that jihadism is a perversion of Islam. That's the kind of message that we get from you know, every European political leader. We had it from George W. Bush and from Obama, right? But actually, jihadism is a perversion of anti-imperialism. It's not a perversion of Islam, and it fills a vacuum where there is very little else happening that represents a genuine alternative for this world that we live in, that we're told is the only way of doing things, and yet produces endless impoverishment and injustice around the world.
So, to move into the present day, you know, just sort of your initial reactions to steps that France and other European countries are taking following the Charlie Hebdo shooting, the various whether it's speech policies that they're putting in place, the surveillance policies. What's your sort of reaction to what we're seeing?
Well, I mean, it's a repetition of a dynamic that we've seen repeated, you know, over at least the last decade, where an incident of this kind is mobilized for a whole series of political projects, one of which is the increase in surveillance. So across Europe, we're seeing you know, the embedding of surveillance in all kinds of agencies, not just the security services. But, for example, in England, there's a piece of legislation going through Parliament now called the Counterterrorism and Security Bill, which would put a requirement on universities to essentially allow the police a veto on who gets to speak on campuses, and a requirement on universities to share all kinds of personal information about students with the police and with intelligence agencies. And then another aspect of this is the kind of wider cultural effects of this kind of mobilization, the Je suis Charlie mobilization, which is to create an atmosphere in France in particular, but also in other parts of Europe, where young Muslims are kind of being subjected to a loyalty test, right? One that's heavily slanted for a particular idea of nationalism, one that is uses the slogans of republican values in France, such as liberty, equality, and fraternity, but in practice, that never translates to people who are not white in France. So we have seen people arrested for posting on Facebook messages critical of the response to the murders of Charlie Hebdo's journalist. We've seen dozens and dozens of young Muslims in France rounded up recently. When you look at the way in which this notion of freedom of expression is being used here, the kind of double standards and contradictions are just incredibly obvious, actually. I mean, it doesn't require any great analysis to point them out. France is a country that banned protests against Israel last summer when Israel was killing children in Gaza and journalists in Gaza. It's a country that has policed very heavily the choice of clothing that Muslim women wear in France. There's all kinds of ways in which this notion of freedom of expression is highly selective. There's this kind of sloganeering that's going on that belies a much more contradictory reality.
Yeah, what seemed so clear to me with the Je suis Charlie kind of response and the huge march that was, I think, over a million people in Paris was that it seemed very convenient for a lot of people to use free expression as a pretext on which to graft a sort of anti-Islam, Islamophobia that people don't want to acknowledge openly, but the sort of full-throated defense of Charlie Hebdo acted as a very clear way to very something that you could just sort of graft onto those pre-existing biases.
Absolutely. I mean, the narrative very quickly that emerged was, you know, freedom of expression is our Western value. You Muslims are people who don't really understand it. You need to absorb it. Your values are violence and fanaticism. Our values are freedom and self-expression. That narrative obviously has a long history. It's the narrative that's been repeated multiple times over the last 20 years around events in Europe and elsewhere, and has ultimately roots in colonialism. But on the left, we've done this job of pointing out the kind of inconsistencies that such a narrative necessarily involves. But I think we've probably not done as good a job as we could of really defining what our version of freedom of expression would look like, right? If we don't want to define freedom of expression in this way that is used as a slogan and a loyalty test, right? So, you know, I will not be able to adopt the slogan of Je suis Charlie because Charlie Hebdo was a magazine that was happy to play with racial stereotypes. It quite rightly sacked one of its journalists for anti-Semitism, but there was no journalist who was sacked for Islamophobia. But to refuse that slogan of Je suis Charlie means that, you know, it's particularly if you're a French Muslim, it means that you are cast out from acceptable society now, and potentially arrested, as a number of young people have been. But we also, I mean, I think we need to get a bit more sophisticated in how we talk about freedom of expression. So we have a, in every society, there are notions of good speech and bad speech. And there is no society that really has an absolute definition of freedom of speech. The United States sometimes describes itself in that way, but of course there are numerous people in prison in the United States for things they've said. There are people such as Stephen Salaita who've lost their jobs for things they've said. Every society has a different way of working out what kinds of speech it disapproves of and the ways of expressing that disapproval. The problem we have is that we are not doing a very good job of examining the politics of that. How do we decide as a society what's acceptable and what's not? So we end up kind of handing over freedom of expression as a slogan to people who are not genuine believers in it and who are using it for agendas that involve racism or imperialism in some form or another.
And as a final question, we've seen in Greece and to a lesser extent in Spain a surge of left wing politics as it results to rejecting austerity measures. I'm curious, is there what's the state of left-wing politics that rejects imperialism, is there any real left-wing movement in that way, in the way that we're starting to see as pushing against austerity?
Firstly, I would say that to my knowledge, the Syriza party in Greece has an admirable position on, for example, questions like Palestine, questions like immigrant rights within Greece, and I don't think there's any reason not to be incredibly excited about what's happening in Greece right now. Obviously, within the European left as a whole, there has been a history of thinking that questions of race and questions of empire can kind of just be put on the back burner, and once we've won the class struggle, as it were, then everything will be okay. And those of us who've come from a politics of black socialism, if you like, or anti-racist socialism, we've constantly been making the argument that you have to see capitalism as a racial capitalism. It necessarily has racism as a core part of it, and therefore you need to take that head on. And to some extent, the left has improved on these questions in Europe, but there's still a lot of challenges on that front. There is exciting new movements. In Britain, there's something called the London Black Revolutionaries, for example, who represent a new generation of young people of colour who have been inspired to some extent by the Black Lives Matter movement here in the US and are doing very similar things in London, where we have as significant problems of police racism as the ones here in the US. You know, you're seeing a lot of movements like that that are beginning to spring up here and there, and that represent a challenge to the mainstream left around its politics of race. And so that's incredibly exciting.
Well, I think that is a great place to leave it. Arun Kundani, thank you so much for coming back on Radio Dispatch.
Thank you for having me.
You should follow Arun Kundani on Twitter. His Twitter handle is ArunKundani.
And his book, once again, is The Muslims Are Coming. Very, very highly recommended.
Yes, yes. Super, super highly recommended. I'm so glad that you got Arun back on the show.
Yeah. So.